So where we were last week, we had, for our purposes, we focused on a particular, right, on a story, a thematic story which deals with the city of Luz, which, for reasons we discussed last week, becomes in rabbinic narrative, becomes a city in which no one dies. And the interesting thing about it is that, as opposed to seeing this as paradise, the rabbis say that there came a time. Basically, everybody in the city at such point when they became very old, they would leave the city walls to greet the angel of death that was beside the city.
So they aged, but they didn't die.
They aged, but they didn't die.
Wow, that's an interesting fact. So they aged infinitely, but they didn't die.
Yes.
Okay. And so
eventually their lives would become sickening to them, and they would leave and die. Now we pointed out that there is a text variant. The version that we have in the printed Talmud says that they would go outside the city. The version in most manuscripts of the Talmud and in parallel Midrashim is they would be taken out of the city.
But they would be sick. They would want to be taken. I mean, they had a desire.
Yes, they had the desire to be taken out.
Mine is oppressive.
Okay. And so we're talking about assisted suicide,
right.
Not
by
euthanasia.
Yeah.
But Robert, there are people who want to go out, but they can't walk anymore, or are these people
so that's what we're playing. That's what we're playing with. Okay.
Well, the mind's oppressive. That's saying body.
Yeah, it means that. But I think the mind being oppressive means that somehow their experience of existence becomes right. It doesn't tell you why. It might be that their mind becomes oppressive because their bodies become oppressive. Although that's projection. Yeah, absolutely. And we started this with a long excursus. On the relationship between narrative and law. So we have this story, and what I said is from a narrative perspective, this is a story about whether life is always a gift. It seems clear that this story tells you that one can imagine circumstances in which life is not, from a cost-benefit analysis, worth living. This seems to be a rational choice. It seems to be a rational choice.
This is
my daughter Chanaleah.
Who?
Chanaleah.
Chanaleah. Hi, Chanaleah. Okay. Sorry.
That's what we can do from a narrative perspective. The problem is that on the question of how legally one deals with people whose lives have become oppressive to them, but who cannot die naturally, right? That's pretty much as anything other than a speculative phenomenon. That's a modern question, right? We now have vastly more cases of people in situations like that, right? Who can say with some cause, I find life burdensome, and life will extend infinitely unless I do something. So the question is, can we translate this story into a legal precedent? So what I wanted to do is, right, having gone through... Yes, Deborah?
If we're talking about a sort of psychological burdensomeness of life, then if that doesn't require any physical symptoms, then why couldn't you 1,000 years ago have been 30 years old and desperate to be dead and had a good chance of living another 50 years?
Okay.
By the way,
and how is that different?
The kind of life is very... Can I just bring up the point that... For most people, it may not be a problem. Well, I shouldn't say it. There's issues with youth. The major issues in many realms is the fact that life expectancy is doubled. All Methuselah and all those other guys aside, I mean, the fact is that it's just about doubled.
Average life expectancy. But if you got through adolescence,
you got a pretty good guess.
A healthy, well-fed man who made it to his 30s was probably going to make it to his 70s or 80s.
Right.
It's just that most people didn't make it that far.
Right. You think, well, that's a good point.
Okay. But, so how is this different than a suicidal depression in a 30s?
So now we have to figure out. So we have to figure out what it means. Right. So what you're saying, it is correct that you can take this story as right. That you could plug into the story and say, why is it only the elders who leave the city? Right. What about the teenagers who are disappointed in love? Right. Why don't they leave the city?
They might not die just by leaving the city.
Interesting.
They become mortal.
Yeah, they become mortal. Okay. That's interesting.
You're 15, becoming mortal doesn't mean that you died now.
Right, it's an interesting question. It may be that you, right, it may be that the point is that these people are living magically, and so as soon as they leave the magical protection, they die, and other people, it doesn't mean everyone who leaves the city automatically dies immediately.
Well, there is also a profound way to look at it, is that if you're young in a sense, it's pathology.
Yes, so we can make a stronger argument that, right, like saying that only, that is only one reason which we would tolerate as a rational choice, right, which is extreme age coupled with immortality.
And we do have a text,
one text says when they became extremely elderly, as opposed to just when their minds became oppressive to them.
In that sense, things are better now than they used to be, because today, if I'm 30 and I'm in a suicidal depression, I have a prayer of treatment.
Right.
If I were 1,000 years ago and 30 and in a suicidal depression, I might be condemned to live that way for 50 years.
So.
Unless I actually kill myself.
Yeah, I would rather not take that end right now.
Okay.
But the Gemara does talk about suicide in cases of pain or humiliation.
Yeah, we'll get to that, right? That's not here. So the issue we have already, right, is when we try and take the story normatively, right, then we start putting all sorts of details into the story, questions. Does the story apply here and not there? Which, for example, the distinction between whether you go out or people take you out, mm-hmm. the fact that it varies in manuscript probably means that the storyteller didn't care. Right? It might just mean the fact that we distinguish between they became extremely elderly or their minds were oppressive. So it might mean that each story has a very distinct normative slant, that somebody says, right, that one person told the story with when they became very elderly because they wanted to say, and that's the only reason, right, that you can do this, whereas the other person wrote it as their minds became oppressive so that you could create a broader category of rational choice. Or it's possible that the stories were never told with that kind of precise normative consequence, and so you told the story the way it came out that time, the way you thought it would make most psychological sense. And now we are plugging tremendous significance legally into typos, or normal variants of oral literature. Right, that's the tension in taking a narrative and using it as law. But again, realizing on issues like this, really most what we have mostly is narrative. So I argued is that the one thing we can take out of it, right, is that the value behind this story is that life is not always a benefit. What the normative consequences are of acknowledging that life is not always a benefit are not clear.
Just a quick question. Mind oppressive is what they go out.
Yes.
According to what you have it here, and very old a taken out.
So well, no, it doesn't line up.
Not true?
Doesn't
okay,
line up.
Sorry. Okay.
Doesn't line up. They're just variants. They're just variants. Okay, so then I wanted to study the normative treatment of this by the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who was the great medical ethicist, halachic medical ethicist, who died earlier this year. He was the posek of Shari Tzedek Medical Center. And he's responding to someone...
Source 4.
He's responding to somebody else's question. And now that person seems to have, and we'll see him again in this week's sources, seems to have been comfortable making the conventional halachic distinction between direct and indirect causation. And that person seemed to be comfortable saying that if you can, we simply read this story as saying that they left the city, and leaving the city is not seen as directly causing your death, right? Because there's nothing deadly about the outside air. All leaving the city does is make you mortal, which makes it possible for you to die. Right. So there. Right. So this is a. So this can be seen, he thinks, as a conventional case in halacha of doing something which has an indirect and not inevitable consequence. Okay. Now we can talk about whether it's not inevitable or not, because once you become immortal, right? Because if you're becoming mortal, you are eventually going to die. And we then have an interesting halachic debate about whether the obligation of Pikuach nefesh, right, of saving one's life, applies not only when you are threatened specifically with mortality, but whether you violate it simply by moving from an immortal to a mortal condition, right? Whether it's considered suicide, right, to actively move oneself, right, from being immortal to mortal, or whether, right, whether the whole prohibition assumes the context of mortality, and once you're in a situation of mortality, you can't do anything to, right, to actualize, right, to actualize the right death. Right, those are, right, those are, because there is no, so far as I know, there is no formal halakhic treatment of the, right, of the obligations of self-preservation of, right, of immortals. Although this is, you know, obviously a very, very standard mythological premise, right, in the most modern, in modern times, Superman, right, giving up his immortality for Lois Lane.
But maybe we mean things like you're not to smoke, you're not to do things that are unhealthy.
So we can divide it, right? There's immortality to mortality, right, which we could say is not relevant in this category at all because the natural condition of a human being is mortality, and no one argues an obligation to be immortal, right? Then within the condition of mortality, there's a question of whether whether you're obligated to live as long as possible, or simply to avoid doing things which will likely cause death, right? Which are as Jerry correctly points out, is a smoking issue, right? Because the problem with smoking is that although there you deal with a more complicated question of consequences as a result of a series of actions, right? Because no specific cigarette has a statistically significant impact on your life expectancy, right? Smoking cigarettes has a statistically significant impact, but if you ask the question, can I take this puff of this cigarette? Right, it's deeply unlikely that it's forbidden, because what are the consequences of your life expectancy? Infinitesimal, right? Less than the chance of crossing the street.
But it's addictive.
Yes, so we can try and do it.
Taking this puff means I'm going to have to take.
Okay.
Good. It can't be that.
Now I'm addicted.
The theories of medicine, which involve belief and a whole bunch of other issues. Whether you believe is a requisition, or that you would die anyway. I mean, it can't be that you would be held to be bringing on your own death. Unless you believe, I guess the issue is, if you deeply believe that by smoking you are bringing on your death, maybe in that case you could argue it. But I would think an average person who just puffs away their relationship.
Well, now they know. Now they know it.
Well, I don't know. Global warming, death by, I don't know.
It's changed.
So you think I can take a sip of arsenic every day?
Well, that actually works, you know, positively. Right? It builds up immunity. You do. You drink oranges. You eat oranges. Yes, Ross.
I want to know what this fits. These are case studies that were.
Okay, I don't see the immediate relevance. Maybe in a couple of weeks, but I don't see the. I don't think it matters so much this week. Okay, I would hold off till we have a whole series of narratives about it and see if it ties in. Okay, so the. So Tzitz Eliezer is presented with this, right, with this interlocutor, who is really comfortable with this distinction between indirect and direct death. Actually, there's a double answer that the person gives, but what I want to make a broader normative point, which is problematic of this whole discussion. There are any number of attempts to try and distinguish between the ways in which death is caused, and these have immediate impact in Israel now, where apparently the way that the Israeli government, which had the Orthodox parties that had to contend with, deals with the do not resuscitate issues, but now dealing with removal of care issues, is by putting respirators on timers, so that which have to be reset in order to keep going. So you don't have to actively turn off a respirator ever. You simply have to fail to turn a respirator back, right, to reset the timer on a respirator. And it may be that, you know, because of the dangers involved, that you can set up a more complicated fail-safe system where the respirator automatically resets itself unless you do something which prevents the respirator from resetting itself. So it won't go off if somebody forgets. But that is built on the assumption that this distinction between how you cause death, is legally and morally significant. The problem I have with all such attempts is that everybody wants to say they're only permitted when you have some reason to, right, some reason that you would, right, that absent a legal barrier, you would encourage right, the person's death. And the theories most of these work under is, well, this is not really killing. If it's not really killing, then why would you be responsible if you did the same thing to somebody who was perfectly healthy? So there's a bind in all those theories, which they have ways around, but it's a straightforward bind.
None of these would have an impact for somebody
who's healthy. No, suppose you have a 5-year-old who's capable of complete recovery, and the nurse unplugs their respirator. Right, that ought to be murder. And we want it to be. We do prosecute people for that.
Certainly, that's not somebody who's completely healthy.
Okay, but somebody whom there is no incentive, right? There's no reason that we would treat killing them as anything other than murder, right? If we say that the mode of killing, right, is really that normatively significant that we don't view you as having killed that person, then the same thing applies to everybody. So the problem
you're
of...
You're saying if the mode is murder in one case, it's murder in all cases.
Yes. And if it's not murder in one case, it's not murder in all cases. So attempts to solve the problem, right, technically by saying, well, the way we can kill people whom we think ought to die is by using a technically legitimate means is deeply problematic because you can, right, once you declare the means technically legitimate, why is it limited to the cases in which you think the outcome is valuable?
If it goes beyond the mode, it's nothing to do with the mode. It's either the mode or it's not the mode.
Right, so you need to give some normative weight to the question of whether this person ought to live.
Right.
Right. It's not a technical means cannot be sufficient.
Yeah, not right.
Yes, Deborah.
But they might still be necessary. We need a combination of context and method as a justification in other places.
Yeah, so you have to. Right, it's just saying it's not sufficient.
Right.
What frightens the Tzitz-Eliezer, I think, is that it seems that his respondent is not realizing that. And it's just saying, well, okay, well, this looks like a case where, you know, this looks like a case of suicide, why should it be okay? Oh, don't worry, it's okay because it's indirect. Right, and that really, right, and that I think legitimately frightens the Tzitz-Eliezer. Like, what are you talking about if you're only making a mechanical distinction? That's not going to work. So he comes up with a whole series of other distinctions. Right, first of all, he says, right, maybe here you're not causing death at all.
Where are you now? I'm sorry.
I'm now in the second paragraph in source 4. Right, so he says, indeed you answered well, this was only done via indirect causation and by removal of that which prevented natural death. This is something we'll pick up again this week, the distinction between indirect causation and removal of removals as opposed to actively doing things. That'll be, right, we'll pick it up in the next packet. But he says, look, I can add to this by saying that here, the removal of the prevention is not something that in the natural world would cause death. Leaving a city, right, leaving a city is not something that ordinarily causes death. What you're doing here is removing a supernatural protection as opposed to a natural protection, and therefore, therefore he wants to argue that maybe this case can be completely removed from the normative, because giving up a supernatural protection is not the same thing as giving up a natural protection. Right, that walking outside the city of Luz is not the same thing as walking out from behind a shield into a hail of bullets.
Is that because it's supernatural? Because it's supernatural, or is that because it's something that... suppose I'm the bubble boy. Can I leave my bubble? Because that wouldn't hurt anybody else?
You could argue, and I think what he means is the first, although I see how you can argue in his language the second.
Yes,
but you can argue the issue of supernaturalness or is the issue of generalizability. Right? Deborah wants to argue it's generalizability.
Regard to the rest of the world would not be considered. Regard to the rest of the world, the bubble boy leaving a bubble.
No, because if you leave the bubble, you're not...
No,
right.
The rest of... Yeah, but
so maybe he has the right to live a normal life, and if he kills him,
okay.
then...
I don't think that's what he means. I don't think that's what he means. I think that's too technical. Okay. Right. Then he goes on and he says, all these rationales for leniency, right, say that they can go out themselves, but he says, but if you look at other texts, he doesn't have the manuscripts, but he has parallel midrashim. It doesn't say they go out; it says they're taken out. So maybe you're never allowed to do anything.
Other people can.
Maybe you're allowed to allow other people to do it to you, and then you'll say, well, what about those other people? What makes them? Right, why are they allowed to do it? Maybe they're Gentiles, and maybe Gentiles don't have the same rules as Jews do in this regard. Or maybe you're simply not responsible for Gentiles. We'll see that theme later. Right? Maybe he believes that you're entitled to indirectly cause Gentiles to transgress. He's scrambling, right?
What is he saying there? In the third paragraph?
In the third paragraph. Right, he says, at the end of the third paragraph, he says, in that case, there would be two positive elements here. First, it was a matter of indirect causation, such that in the rest of the world, there is no counter to such causation. And also, that it was via others and not via themselves. And we can also conclude it was likely that they were taken out by means of Gentiles. Okay, and then he goes further, and he says, and who says that the people in the city of Luz are Jews? Maybe the people in the city of Luz are Gentiles themselves. Because after all, they're founded, as we learned last week, by a Canaanite refugee. Maybe the Talmud has no interest in taking their practice as normative. Maybe the Talmud is interested in telling this story tangentially. This story tells us how greatly this Canaanite who let the Jews into the Canaanite city of Luz was rewarded. That his descendants became immortal. And by the way, it didn't last. They didn't choose it. Who says that the inhabitants of the city of Luz, in their practices, are taken as moral exemplars, and that we just because they sometimes walked outside the city, that if you were Jewish and you follow halacha, you would be allowed to. Okay, and then he says, and you know what? Maybe the whole story isn't right. It's an allegory anyway. He moves into Maral. So Maral, who always functions on shifting levels of reality, which are difficult to follow. Samarel says this is not a physical story at all. What it means by leaving the city really is leaving the space of God.
And do that on purpose?
And the city and Luz is just an allegory for people. And you don't do that on purpose, right? It's just that when you become very elderly, it'll have some kind of spiritual significance. When you hit such a point when you no longer appreciate X, and if you take that. That has the story has no normative implications in the real world at all, and then he offers yet another interpretation of his own, which I don't really understand, which is parallel to there's another city in the Talmud in which nobody ever dies because they always tell the truth, and in that city at some point when somebody comes in who lies, somebody dies and they throw them out because they're afraid that having them in the city will cause lies to be told, which will then lead to the end of their immortality. And so he says maybe what it means to leave the city means to leave the spiritual level the city was on. So the end of this, right, what the Tzitzit Eliezer is really doing is removing this story entirely from circulation legally. Right? And he's throwing the kitchen sink at this story. At the end of it, there's no way. He wants to make sure that nobody will ever cite this story in a legal context. Which is great, except that the story is all we have.
This is a contemporary response.
Okay, so that's right, so here we have right. So you have his interlocutor, who seems to take the story straightforwardly. It says they walked outside the city. That teaches us normatively that you're allowed to walk outside cities if walking outside cities will cause you to die. Right, now we can just try and generalize the action of walking outside a city. Right, and the Tzitzit Eliezer himself takes this on. He can take this on normatively and say no. Even within that level, we have an ambiguity in the text, so you have to figure out which generalization you can make. But ultimately, he says, I don't want to play that game with this story. I want to take this story out of circulation. Now, the reason he wants to take this story out of circulation is that he doesn't like the normative implication. Right, he doesn't think that the implication that the straightforward normative implication of the story, which is that there is a technical means of evading the prohibition against suicide, which one is entitled to avail oneself of, right? If one hits a point with which we see that as a reasonable decision, right? That's not a decision. That's not a solution he's willing to work with. He doesn't tell you why.
He was not part of the separators on Tom.
I don't know if he was involved in that one or not. I really don't.
And he must have been involved. He was the rabbi of the Pasek Peshar Tzedek. He must have had many, many, many cases brought to him. And he always
said, all of them are still alive.
No, we'll see. This is one paragraph.
Yeah, but what you're saying is he's trying to get as far as possible from the idea of ever be a time when there's a trade-off.
In this story's implication, right, we'll have to see how he reacts, right, that, you know, he's one of the first ones who strung the narratives together, who pulled together all the narratives that have potential implications. Hmm. So we have to see his reaction to all the stories.
Okay, yeah, one of the problems with this story, I can see his problems with, is that there is no discussion of why to choose to do so. I mean, he may want to take it to a realm where you carefully, where you allow it after it occurs. Originally, he doesn't think it exists here. I mean, I'm saying it's one possibility. I don't know
yes,
where he's going.
It could be, although he could have, you know, in that case, he could have, right, he could have just, you know, he could have said, your distinction is fine. Be careful, of course, because just because the elder of the city of Luz could be, doesn't mean, he could have removed the story in other ways and said, you know what, that the kind of ennui that you feel after 1,000 years is so much greater than anything anybody who only lives to 120 could possibly feel, that the fact that they were allowed to do it teaches us nothing normatively. Right? He could have done that also.
That's a very different relation to life than saying sick or you're in pain and so on. I mean,
right.
Life itself could become so unbearable that you let someone kill himself because of length of. At some point, are you going to bring in choose life, the Deuteronomy thing?
Not yet. I'm just doing the narrative, though.
Okay. Second meeting.
What I'm saying is, the Tzitzit Lieber had a number of options for removing this story. He doesn't choose to address the question of motive, right, where there were certainly ways to remove it, right? Instead, what he says is, whatever their motive was, I don't accept a technical solution.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and again, you know, and again, his argument here is designed to prevent you from coming up with any technical conclusions based on this story. But that again, so now you that again, what I want to argue is that it's that the reading he's opposing, he's right to oppose it, because to treat this story as something written precisely for its legal implications is not true to the genre. On the other hand,
the genre
is narrative. It's not a narrative which is it's not written. Right? I don't think the story is written to tell you the details of assisted suicide law. Right? That's not what the story is about, and it's not fair to put that weight on the language of the story, as we can see, because all the key issues, which is means and motive, the texts vary. Right. So clearly, to put that kind of weight on it is just not fair. On the other hand, in Tzitzit Eliezer, simply removing the story from circulation leaves us with nothing, and that doesn't seem fair either, because all the allegorizing, it seems to me again not to be fair to what the story is about. The simplest way of reading the story is that this story is about a claim that there are times when life is not a benefit. And if you want to figure out how one is supposed to approach end-of-life issues, that makes a huge difference, and it's not fair to take that out of play. I think this narrative really does that for you. It tells you that if you want to come up with if you want to end up with an argument that says Judaism ultimately just says choose life, right, or where there's life, which I think is the way Rabbi David Feldman framed it in his latest book, right, that you can't say that on a pure values level if you know the story. The story does tell you that life is not always a benefit. You can make different arguments. You can make a duty argument and say that this story is about people who breach their duty to live, even though life is no longer a benefit for them. Right? You can make technical arguments and say that it's true that life is not a benefit, but nonetheless there are always technical prohibitions against taking it. But you can't do that from the premise that the reason for all that is that every moment of life God gives you is a gift, and it's always a lack of gratitude, right, to seek to turn it down. Mm-hmm. Because the story, I think that read simply, right, that's the one point the story makes, is that there are times when life is not a benefit.
And there must have been truths about this over the centuries. I know they didn't have the technology, but there must have been similar issues. You would hold food, you would do a cure that could, you know, could you do something?
Well, so the Shulchan Aruch has an explicit discussion, mm-hmm. right, and the reason, well, I'm trying not to treasure check, right, the passive, active, or removal versus, right, mm-hmm. that distinction is there in Shulchan Aruch.
For Shabbos? No, for this?
For this.
Oh, okay.
Right, but I'm trying to, but whether you read it that simply or not is, right, is itself a question, right? So I don't want to read the law, and I want to read the narrative without assuming that it has to fit with what we know to be the law. Okay. Although,
but when you say we're left with nothing, I'm wondering about that. Really, there was nothing? There's nothing else?
I don't think those precedents deal with cases of people who are going to die shortly.
Uh-huh.
And they work on a notion of body-soul relationship that is not clear as transferable to the right to the kind of medical circumstances we find out now.
What do you mean by that?
They have a notion that the soul really wants to leave the body, but it's being prevented by some supernatural means, right? And you can
taking away the thing that's preventing the thing.
Yeah, right.
It sounds exactly like what we have. Replace supernatural with medical, and
yeah,
the sentence is exactly right.
Let's leave the formal halacha out of it. Again, to me, the big shift is just numbers. You know, and I think numbers have an impact. Mm. You know, that again, when I read the thing in Brody's book that, you know, 2/3 of current hospital deaths were delayable. Right, you could have done something to make the person die later. You choose not to. That's a totally different moral universe.
Two-thirds hospital deaths.
You could have
done something
to prolong life.
But those methods didn't exist.
No, I'll say, but now exactly
so
the point.
The numbers go way up just because of technology.
Yes,
right?
but the moral universe, right? The moral universe of doctors who are making this decision 10 times a week, right? There are things you can do legally on a case-by-case basis that you can't do all of a sudden when it becomes en masse. Right, it might have been that you had a situation once we would say, wow, in really wild cases, we can, right, we'll find some technical means to allow it. But when you have 1,000 cases like that a week,
it's routine.
Right, then the whole calculus changes. Just as we have that problem with Agunot, where in individual Agunot cases, we would always find ways of handling it. But when you all of a sudden had a mass Agunot, situation, right? Because of the women who can't remarry because their husbands were missing, and now we have the possibility of husbands refusing
to give a gift.
Right. So ways we might have found of invalidating the marriage, right? You know, in specific cases, don't work because now you have to invalidate all marriages if you did that because there's so many cases that you can't come up with rules that are case specific. Right. Every case will have 1,000 cases like it. Okay, so let's deal with the second story now, right? Which is this week's sources. Okay,
I don't think you distributed them.
I'm pretty sure I did. But okay.
Here's the Hebrew for this week. Oh no, it's English on the other side.
No,
here are the sources.
No.
It's. Oh. All right. Here's a two-sided English for you.
Should be two-sided English, two-sided English.
Here's another English. Anyone need an English?
Yeah. We have. Does everybody have English and Hebrew now?
Woman who stopped praying.
One, right, there should be a
two. That's the moral.
Wait, which side is the first side here? They're not numbers.
They're numbers. Yes, they are.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
Oh, the pages are numbered.
Yeah, the pages are numbered.
The sources
one and two.
Right.
So what page are we looking for?
So page one.
So here is.
Page one in the Hebrew matches page three in English.
Okay.
And two and four. Yeah.
Do you have the same one? Oh, do you have pages 1 and 2 then?
Just
hold on, Donnelly, do you have pages 1 and 2 in English for me?
Pages
1 and
3.
Okay, so 1, 2, 3. So we want 3 and 4 in English, right?
Is there a page 1 in English, Father?
Yes. No.
Or is the English is all 3 and 4, and the Hebrew is all 1 and 2?
Yes.
Here's an English.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so now this story is not actually found in the Talmud. I'm not sure why, and unfortunately I seem to have lost my CD with the variant Talmud manuscripts this week, so I couldn't check whether there's some manuscripts. It's very strange that this story appears only in some later anthology, but I'm not sure what difference that makes. The story is the following, right? There's a very old woman who comes before Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta, who's already a rabbi of the Tannaic period, and she tells him, I've gotten too old. Right? Rabbi, I've gotten too old. Zikanti, yoter midai. And now my life is a life of nivul. Nivul is a difficult word to translate. I said disgusting, which may be too strong. It's not clear exactly what we used to talk about nivul hamet, right, which is the problem of marring the dead, right? So it's some kind of I would say some kind of aesthetic lack, but I'm not sure exactly how to translate it. But there's something which makes life unpleasant. And she says the reason for it. The reason is that she's incapable of tasting food or drink. Now this is a biblical reference to the character Barzillai HaGiladi, who when offered a post at King David's court after he apparently assists David in his crushing of the revolt of Absalom. So David tells Barzillai that he should come to court, and Barzillai says, "What's the point of my coming to court? I don't have any desire anymore. I won't appreciate court." Right. So she picks up on that. On that notion that that when one becomes old, one loses desire, and she says that without desire, my life is not worth living, and I want to be released from the world. I don't want to live anymore. So he asks her. And this is a very common rabbinic motif. Right? If somebody has experienced something physically exceptional, what gives you what? Right? What you, there must be some metaphysical cause for your physical exceptionalism. So why is it that you're living so long? Right? Do a spiritual accounting and find out what you've done. And she says the reason that I live such a long life is that I always go to the synagogue every morning. You can read it literally as saying it's because she always goes early. I don't think that's what it means. I just think it just means that she made sure that she was in the synagogue for the communal prayer every morning. And that was her merit. So he tells her, don't go to synagogue for 3 days. She doesn't go to synagogue for 3 days. And on the third day, she falls ill and she dies. Okay, and we have a verse from Proverbs, which is the proof that going to synagogue regularly is something that might cause you to live a very long time. So here again, right here, the normative implications are clearer, because here we can't claim it's not talking about Jews. Right, could claim it's a very old woman, but unlikely that. Right, that a woman who actually relates to a Talmudic rabbi would, if she were not Jewish, she would be identified as such. So pretty clearly, right, she goes to shul every day. Pretty clearly, she's
not
Jewish.
Not pretty much proof she's not a Jewish woman.
Well, in that case, the other implication to the story has obviously had other consequences in contemporary halachic discussion. But just she's Jewish. And we can't say that her practice is non-normative because it's acting on rabbinic advice. Mm-hmm. So now we have two questions. A is, how could she do it? And B, how could he give her the advice to do it? Right. So we're going to try and take us through... Rabbi Waldenberg himself treats this story in two different places. And then we'll see, by contrast, the treatment of Rabbi Avadia Yosef, who is Yibadel Chaim, still alive, who is the former Sephardi Chief Rabbi of Israel, and I think at this point, I would be comfortable saying, is the greatest living halachic decisor. Not to mention an astoundingly... Rabbi Avadia Yosef. Avadia Yosef, yeah. Unfortunately, has become better known for his politics than his psak.
We spent most of last spring on
one of his tshuvot. So, an amazing, amazing posik.
So...
No, he's not on this sheet.
He's on the back.
He's here.
The Torah 3 times a week is when the people are wandering, right?
Yes.
You can't go 3 days
without Torah.
Without water and without Torah.
Right.
And so presumably the 3 second days may be a reflection of that.
That's interesting. That's why he told her 3 days so she would miss Torah reading. I like that. That's very good.
Maybe, although 3 days is just enough to establish a pattern, which might be the common reason behind both of them.
Yes, right. That is the right. That's. I was thinking more along Deborah's line, but I like Francis' suggestion that it connects specifically to public Torah reading. I do like that. Okay. So now, what do we do with this? So the Tzitzel Yezer, Rabbi Waldenberg again, And this is the next paragraph of the response that we just read.
Oh, so he's talking to the same person.
He's talking to the same person.
Oh, okay.
Right? You know, that person has these narratives. And he's saying, you know, you put all these narratives together and you reach a normative conclusion. I'm not so sure I'm into that. Hmm. Right? So he says, so while you found this story so simple, right, and you said, hey, he didn't tell her to kill herself. He told her to do something which would remove her, right, which would remove her, her capacity to live. Right? So he told her to not do something as opposed to do something. And apparently, from the person he's writing to seems to think that's fine. Mm-hmm. What's the issue? Right? He's not telling her to do anything. He's telling her to not go to shul. What's wrong with not going to shul, right, and thereby dying? Now, obviously, we'll have to figure out, does he really mean that? Does he mean the same thing about eating? Right? Not clear how far the person that Cecil Ezra is writing to would have gone. But Rabbi Waldenberg immediately jumps on this. And he says, what are you talking about? Right? That's not good enough. You're giving a technical solution. And he thinks that reading this story in a purely technical context is just wrong. Right? You can't derive from the story that it's okay to give people advice to not do things which will, right, as with the result of killing themselves. Right? That's just not okay.
This is where he says that Talipot finds it difficult.
Right. So he says the Midrash Talpiot is a different commentator, right, says he doesn't like this solution at all. And the Midrash Talpiot, right, and he claims there's another narrative which we will get to in 3 weeks, I hope, that says what on earth is Rabbi Yossi doing? Forget the technical means. God owns your life. The one who gives your life should take it. Right? So here the Sitzel Ezra puts that on the table. He said, right, that he's quoting Midrash Talpiot, and he seems comfortable with that claim, that there's no way a human being should ever take a life that God gave. And therefore, he's not comfortable saying that by whatever technical means, it would be okay for Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta to tell the woman to not go to synagogue so as to die. Now, the Midrash Talpiot, the Sitzel Ezra says, has his own reactions to this story. Where he says there are two. But really there are three, and the first one of these is an astounding move. The first one of these is to claim that you read the story entirely right. Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta told her to do this, and it would be murder under most circumstances. But Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta acted this way illegally, under the rabbinic authority to break the law when necessary.
But not because he was helping her.
Not because he was helping her. Because he thought this was a great opportunity to show people how important public prayer was. That by having this woman die as the result of not going to synagogue for 3 days, everyone will understand that ordinarily going to synagogue keeps you alive. And therefore everyone will go to synagogue.
Couldn't we just advertise her great old age?
But you wouldn't know for sure.
Right, you wouldn't know for sure. Right, here he's conducting a scientific test to show the efficacy of prayer for long life. Yes.
And this is the Midrash Talpiot saying this? Who sang this?
This is the Midrash Talpiot.
Okay. Who was living?
I don't know. I have no idea when the Midrash Talpiot is.
Rabbi Hanina ben Targon is part of the Talpiot.
It's part of the Talmud. No. Right, so the Sitzel Ezra says that the Midrash Talpiot's problem with your reading is supported by another narrative, which we haven't seen yet. And in order to resolve the difficulty, the Midrash Talpiot comes up with a series of solutions. He says, maybe we can completely void the normative force of this narrative by claiming that who says that narratives tell us anything about law? Because we can always treat narratives as, we can always claim that narratives are cases, and in specific cases, rabbis have the authority to override the Torah. If you read, if you read biblical narrative, for example, biblical narrative is replete with stories of characters acting extra legally. Rabbi Yehuda Kupperman, the founder of Michola, which was the first, which was I guess the first really rigorous non-based outcome program. The first rigorous post-high school program for women.
It was a teacher's college. Still yeah. is, in fact.
Still is, but I think it was the first serious post-high school program for Orthodox women. Torah program for Orthodox women. So he has a fascinating article in which he argues that the whole theme of Tanakh is the tension between law and narrative, and that it's specifically designed, all the narratives are about cases where you need to break the law. So he takes that as, you know, that other people apparently, my department head was showing me the other, a book or somebody wrote that all the law is a response to the law breaking the narrative.
This
Heschel has a whole book.
Okay.
But I was saying this is a really radical way of taking a specific narrative out of normative context by just saying, you know what, you're right. Every detail of the story is correct. He acted illegally. He acted illegally. We're not casting any aspersions on him because he was entitled to act illegally. But you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Where's the time to act?
So a time to act for Hashem nullifying his Torah is one of the possibly self-conscious rabbinic ironies. There's a verse in Psalms which says in Hebrew, "Eit la'asot la'Hashem hefer u'Torahtecha," which generally is translated to mean, "It is a time to act for God because they have nullified your Torah," but which the rabbis read as, "It is time to act." Right? "It is a time to act for God by nullifying your Torah." And the rabbis used, and right, this became the.
Heferu, was it Sivui instead of Ezra?
Or it's a description, right? They had right. It's a time right in the time for act for God, right? In this time they have acted for God by right. They have nullified your Torah.
They're not reading it. It is time to act for God, nullify the Torah?
No, it's not Pharaoh as opposed to Hey Pharaoh?
Yeah.
Could be, I don't know. Some kind of counter-reading, right, takes place, which has the effect of nullifying the straightforward meaning of this pasuk, and then that becomes the hook on which rabbinic case-specific extra-legal behavior takes place, although one always has to be careful about what case-specific means, because, for example, you're writing notes now, right? That's illegal.
Right? My being here is illegal.
Because you're writing oral Torah. That's not quite the same thing. We didn't treat it that way. But writing...
He said it!
But writing...
He said he blessed the Lashem about it.
Chavetz Chaim said that, I suppose, yeah. Okay. But let's say writing the oral Torah down is a bigger thing, because that temporary emergency situation has now gone on for about 1,800 years. Nonetheless, you know, and every once in a while somebody tries to come with a legal context, a legal implication of it. For example, the Chatam Sofer argued that while one can study Torah for mixed motives or other than pure study, you're not allowed to write oral Torah down for anything other than perfect motivation. Because the exception was only made for those who act with perfect motivation. Or he has a more complicated argument than that, but that's the right, that kind of modus to it. I just think that, you know, to make this claim, you have to be deeply disturbed by the alternative, right? To say that confronted by that, here's a story. It seems like a perfectly straightforward story involving a respected halakhic figure, right? Who gives what seems pretty straightforward advice, and without any hint to just say, oh. That must be an extra legal act, and to do it on the basis of this, you know, a really pretty stretched motivation, tells you how deeply bothered you are by the straightforward reading. Right, you really think that the straightforward reading is impossible, and almost right, and you know, when we've eliminated the impossible, what remains, however unlikely, must be the truth. That's Sherlock Holmes. Okay, then he says, well, maybe this is different, that case is different, because Rabbi Yossi ben Chalasa doesn't really know that she'll die, he's just conducting a scientific experiment. What are the odds, right? If I tell you to stop going to synagogue for 3 days, are you going to die? So maybe Rabbi Yossi ben Chalasa...
Did he terminate the experiment when the subject started dying? Like they do with real...
I don't know, you know, it could be that he tried it on 10 other people and they all lived, so he decided he wasn't responsible at all.
But this brings another thing into play, inevitability.
Yeah, right. It's not inevitable. He certainly doesn't know it's inevitable. Right. You know, we could always try and counter-read the story and say, you know, that He sees her as arrogant, and he's trying to teach, you know, how does she know why she's lived such a long time? Right? So he's just, you know, he's saying, well, you know, you really think that's it? Well, let's see if that's really, let's see if that's really it. Okay, and then he also makes the passive-active distinction. And Midrash Talpiot himself admits that these answers are forced, and he really just leaves it saying, well, I don't know what to do with this story. This is Eliezer himself says, well, you know what? I'm going to pull out the same distinction I made last time, which is to say that causing death by supernatural means is not the same thing as causing death by natural means.
Right? So that the world doesn't see it as a cause and effect.
Yeah.
But right. It's stronger than that, because you're still letting God choose when you die.
Absolutely right. You can just say, right, you can say that, you know, all he's doing is saying you can force God's hand. Now, whether you should act in such a way that God will no longer reward you, and what it means to say that God is rewarding you with a life you don't want, so the only way to get God to do what you want is to transgress. You know, this is a paradox you already have in the Book of Eov, right? When Eov's wife tells him to curse God and die, right? God is afflicting you now, right? But God will stop afflicting you if you just curse Him. So why don't you curse Him, right? That's a kind of paradox that has feet in rabbinic literature. Okay, so Eliezer is fine with that, but then he tells you, right, be that as it may, you can't learn from here to generally permit doing this passively, because it was because the death was supernatural. Okay, right, so he's very concerned, again, to tell you that the technical solution is not going to work, generalizably. Okay?
Could this some are punishable by death by the community?
Yeah.
Is that almost the same thing?
Well, advising people to do things which will get God to kill them, right, is right. You know, usually God kills you because you did something wrong, right? So to advise somebody, right, to do something which ends up having them deserve death at the hands of heaven, right, which is usually a punishment, is peculiar.
But you could advise somebody to live by the strict letter of the law and never do anything extra special so God won't take care of them anymore.
Yes.
Which seems to be what we're doing here.
Yeah, but again, you know, it's like what, you know, it's a peculiar theological claim, right? If God is rewarding people, then presumably He should reward them with what the good thing is. And, right, and to say that you don't want God's... Now, again, there is a whole rabbinic tradition of people, you know...
So why couldn't you just say to God, look, this isn't what I want anymore?
Yes. And again, so this is, you know, plays into the whole rabbinic discussion about suffering, right? You know, where God gives you suffering so that you learn reward. And somebody, you know, and there are rabbis who say, you know, okay, you take the suffering and the reward, I'll deal with both of them. Right? So there is, again, you know, this gets us into a broader rabbinic discussion about how theologically one is supposed to relate to suffering, which I don't need to do in this context. I want to get to Tzitzit Eliezer in the preceding shiv, actually, is, I think. In a much earlier tshuva. So he's right. He says, "This is on page 4, the first source." So he deals with an interesting implication of what he just said. What we're saying is that supernatural cases are different. What about praying for people to die? Like, can I pray for somebody who is suffering to no longer suffer? And it would seem, if his distinction is between supernatural and natural, that maybe I should at least be able to pray for God to remove whatever is keeping his personal life.
Can't you pray for God to remove their suffering without that meaning that you're praying for them to be dead?
Yes, I could. The question is, can I, but am I allowed to pray specifically for them to die? Because it seems unlikely that God will remove their suffering any other way.
Let's just suppose for a moment that you're praying for somebody.
Yeah.
Right? And you like this person.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't you want to leave open in your prayer the possibility that God would swoop in, remove all of their problems, and turn them back into a young, healthy 20-year-old?
You're praying for a miracle, then.
Okay, what's wrong with that?
Because you might not want to pray for a miracle, because that's really unlikely. You might want to pray for God to do what He usually does, which is to behave in a natural way. And death is a natural thing here, and miracles are not.
Mm. It seems to me that you could plausibly say, please make him stop suffering, and make the reasonable claim that that does not mean please kill him.
Okay, that's fudges. So now you're just playing out, you know, what do you really mean? What do you mean, God, if you're not going to take away his suffering, kill him? Any other way, kill him or not?
Probably I'd mean one way or the other, take away his suffering. I'd rather you do
okay,
it.
Okay, so that would just try to, that would just, yeah. That would just, you know, being mealy-mouthed. I'm not so into that. Okay. So Zinzalander says that in the first paragraph, he gives you a hint of where he's coming from. He says, in real life, at the end of the first line, in real life, we frequently see that this type of patient, you know, there's a moment when that patient wants for death, and then they get used to their suffering, and all of a sudden they want life. And so he thinks it's very, right, and, you know, he flips and he expresses desire for life, he thinks of repentance, and he answers, Amen, to those who bless him with a complete recovery. And therefore, how can we take the responsibility of praying for his death, as it is possible in the moment we pray that he desires to live, and thus we have fallen into sin? So this starts from the premise that maybe you're right, that when people no longer want to live, that you're not doing anything, right, that by praying for their death, you would be doing something right, because you're asking for what they want. But you don't know what's going on inside a person's brain at the time you're praying, and people's thoughts are variable. And so it's just too risky to rely, right? It's too risky to rely on a person's intent as the basis for your decision.
What's the move we'll make? I'm sorry.
Prayer can be active, sure. But on the other hand, you might be praying. Praying might not be direct, right? If I'm praying for God to remove whatever is keeping him alive, so that's, right, removal.
But you mean he's not saying that?
Right. I mean, in the simplest way, we're just shifting now into prayer as an action.
Yeah, I think his simplest way of thinking is that praying is an action.
Okay.
Well, and he's telling you why he thinks it's wrong to take this person's life away.
Yeah, and he thinks that acting to take someone's life away, right, even by prayer, is just too much of a responsibility. You can't rely, at least if your basis for doing so is the person's expression of their suffering, that's insufficient. So he says, you know what, in cases like that, he thinks what you can do is you can be passive and not engage in supernatural means of extending such lives, and he quotes our story.
Which one?
The story of the old lady.
You mean I don't have to pray for him to live? What's a supernatural means?
It means that you're allowed to stop going to shul.
No. In a real life case,
I don't have to pray for them to live.
Right? But supernatural means doesn't mean I don't have to perform a kidney transplant.
No, he doesn't mean extraordinary means.
Yeah.
Right? Supernatural means. Right? Toaliot skuliot.
Who in their right mind would pray to prolong someone's suffering?
You pray for someone's life. Pray to extend their life,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Assuming that you know a great deal about their internal state and assuming you know a lot, if you...
Speaking of which, there was a request that we at least think for a moment during the shir of a Yola at Etadea.
Could you tell us who she is?
A relative is... So here the Sicilianzer seems to think that he acknowledges the point that there are times when life might not, right, when life might not be a benefit, but or at least he acknowledges that there are times when people might not perceive life as being a benefit, and that would change your moral relationship to their life.
And you could pray for their death if you could get the
time. And you could pray for their death if you would know that.
Yeah.
Right? Now, whether it's... Now, he doesn't tell you... He hasn't come up with a way of saying why prayer as opposed to other means. Right? He's not interested in that in this tshuva. Right? So he doesn't have to deal with... Since this is a case dealing entirely with prayer... He doesn't have to deal with the technical problems he had to deal with in the other tshuva. So he ends up saying, you know what, I just think that in these cases, you're best off not doing anything. And he tells you, then he goes on to tell you, you know what, that we understand that we might not hold the people accountable themselves for praying for death, all right, because it's unreasonable in some cases to expect people to do otherwise. But you don't have to go along with that. Okay, so here there's more. So here, when you all of a sudden remove the technical problem, he becomes much more amenable. Right now, he's dealing with caution, as opposed to the throwing answers at the problem which he had previously. Here he just says, you know what? I accept that the story of Yosef ben Chalafta teaches me that you don't always have to do everything to keep somebody alive. Right? He's willing to take that. Right, that's an outcome of the story, and you know, and this I think is a good reading. Right, that's something that he says. You know, on a narrative level, that story tells me that I don't have to do everything to keep somebody alive.
Prior story we just read.
Yeah. On a normative level, he says, you know, that the fact that I don't have to do everything doesn't mean that there's any specific thing I can do that will shorten life. Right? He's not willing to take that chance. But he's willing to concede that to make the counterclaim, which is that life is always worth living. People who decide that their lives are not worth living are definitionally sinning. Right? That he understands is against the narrative level of the story, and because he's managed to defang that story, so it has no practical implications in the physical world. It only deals with metaphysics, so he can admit that. Yes,
Deborah. But this totally guts the whole idea of a living will or a power of attorney or a healthcare proxy, because it would appear that so long as a person is capable of thought, I don't know what you do with somebody who's in a coma or brain dead, but so long as somebody is capable of thought, even if they're not capable of expressing it, they can always change their mind, and their current state of mind is what determines things. So, and you can't know their current state of mind, therefore you can't make decisions
for them. Sure, but
again,
we're not dealing with those kind of cases yet, because we're not dealing with any. He's only willing to say this right now because he's not dealing with anything other than prayer. So living wills don't matter to us on that.
But even a living will that says, "I want you to pray for me to be dead,"
would not be enough.
We couldn't even follow that.
Yes, I think that would be true.
I would think Kavah Homer, a living will that says, "You know,
probably
slip my throat."
Probably again, but whatever. Right. We haven't seen, right, what the Tzitzit has done is he's removed all general implications of these narratives, and we'll have to see what he does in real life. Now, just for contrast, we'll finish there. I wanted to just show you Rav Avadya Yosef, who happens, right, now he's not interested in end-of-life issues at all here. He's dealing with the very prosaic question, right, Rav Avadya Yosef, right, it's the name of his book. So he's dealing with a very prosaic question, which is, can you turn on the water in a building on Shabbos?
Hot water.
Can you turn on the hot water? Mm-hmm. Okay, right, can I turn on the hot water in a building on Shabbos, even though that will have the consequence of causing cold water to flow into the hot water heater? And the prosecutor says, well, you know what, that since it seems to him that you're not actually causing the cold water to flow in. What you're doing is you're removing the hot water, which was keeping the cold water from flowing in. So all you're doing is, right, or you're removing the tap, which kept, right, you're opening the valve, which was previously keeping the cold water from flowing in. So he said, look, you see that it seems, right, that all you're doing here is removing a prevention. And he said, how do I know that removing a prevention is okay? Well, look, Rabbi Yossi ben Chalapta told this woman not to go to shul. And if Rabbi Yossi ben Chalapta, in a murder case, right, in a life and death case, could say it's okay because you're just removing a removal, so then of course you can remove the barrier to the cold water flowing into the hot water. Now, in the end, he rejects that. At the very end of his response, and he still says you're not allowed to turn on hot water on Shabbat unless you have a special custom design system by me in your house.
Which has never been built.
Which has been built. Which, okay. Absolutely. Which has been, yes, yes.
Say what? No.
I have designed a hot water system for houses that does actually, that is a, you can actually turn on Shabbat. So if you're ever building a private home and you want hot water on Shabbat, you should come talk to me.
It's very simple, right? You just talk.
No, there's no water pressure. No water pressure. You can do it by putting the tank on top, but if you want to put the tank on the
roof. You put the tank on the roof.
You can turn off the water from coming
out. Well, then if you turn on the hot water,
No, if there's a special pipe coming off, you can have the pressure.
Right, out. But you can't have pressure on your hot water tap unless there's water pushing from behind.
True. Yes. That's true. So in any case, but, you know, so this is my proprietary.
That's why you put the tank
this
on.
Is my proprietary thing. Well, so if you want to build a house, with a halakhically
valid water. So how does it affect that we turn on hot water? We don't.
Okay. In apartment buildings, there's a broader issue, because in apartment buildings there's so much water in the pipe that some people have argued that the odds that you're actually causing cold water to flow into the boiler
that wasn't already coming in
is different. Also, apartment buildings often have the tanks on the roof, so it's not dependent on water pressure the same way. But in private houses, in most of them, you're not allowed to turn on the hot water on Shabbat unless you have a custom built system. But it's, you know, so Ravadia, possibly just because he's not interested in this question at all, right? He's not talking about end-of-life issues, he's talking about hot water systems. He just reads the story entirely, perfectly, straightforwardly. The story says that you can do things by removing preventions. End of discussion.
But he says we don't, relations are concerned.
Well, isn't murder a biblical violation?
Yes, but to say that this case of the hot water is exactly like the case of removing, not praying, he's not sure. Maybe there are things about the hot water system that make it more direct.
But
well,
life to life, death to death.
Suppose I've got somebody face down in the bathtub and I want to turn on the tap. In what way is that? Is that a different analogy?
No. So that's where, you know, I think the only reason Ravadia says this is because he's not interested in this question. Right, this is a tangent, and if you asked him, am I allowed to? Does this mean that if somebody's face down in the bathtub, right, that I can open the tap because all I'm doing is removing the barrier to the water? Right, he would say no. Of course, right, you're out of your mind. Right, he would find some way. Right, he would find some way of distinguishing. But it just shows you how depending on how you quote this, you know, Sintelander has all these ways out of the story, and Ravadia just says no. The story teaches me this very straightforward halachic principle, which is that removal of removals is not a problem. Removal of removals is a very important principle in contemporary halakha because it is the basis for most of the tricks used to keep factories going on Shabbat in Israel.
And Shari Tzedek.
Yes,
and
right.
Hospitals and the electrical company and the...
Sure. I had suggested at one point, I did not build it in the same house in which I built the hot water system, that we could design a Shabbat switch that would let us all turn on lights.
Well, isn't that what they use the charity?
They have Groma things, yeah. Right? They don't have Monea Monea for that. They have Monea Monea for factories.
Hmm. Removal of
removals? Removal of removals, yeah. So I had suggested that we run a light switch.
Preventing of prevention.
We have a heat-sensitive light switch, but instead of actually putting your palm on the thing, what you do is you have a heat shield on it, you put your palm next to it, and then you remove the heat shield. That way you would have just be preventing intervention. As opposed to,
who says you're going to remember to put the heat shield back before you put your hand?
Yeah, yeah. It was a bad idea, and I
put the heat shield on a switch,
on a spring, so it slides back into place.
Yeah, you know, there are complicated ways of doing it, but I thought that might work. Probably it wouldn't, but
it
okay.
It could just be a bad idea.
But I just have
the smart house. This would be the halakhic house.
Yeah. Well, I was given the commission of trying to build a house in which you could do everything you do during the week basically on Shabbos, but do it legally.
And this seemed to you like a good idea?
And could you eat treif also
in that house? And, you know, that's a more complicated thing. You know, you have to denature the food and reconstitute it. Okay, that's where we are now. I think is that we have these two narratives. You get to see, right? Both the narratives do, I think, on a narrative level, convey this idea that there are times when life is not a benefit, but you see the resistance to the normative, right, to the normative results, even though if the stakes were lower, you get to see in Ravadia's trip, if the stakes were lower, it'd be pretty clear what the normative results were.
But yes, you say he's addressing it, really.
Right, but what that tells you is if the stakes aren't high, mm-hmm. Right, that's what the story means.
Yeah.
It's because the stakes are high, right, that when you actually have to deal with these issues, you have to read these stories out. But then again, my problem is, but it's not clear to me we have anything in law except narrative on these issues. And therefore, if you really read these stories out, then you have nothing to go on at all. So we'll read two more stories over the next 3 weeks,
so
and we'll see.
Is it interesting that in both these cases...
I'm doing the stories in particular order. All right, so you'll have to see. Right, the next story will deal straight on with praying for death. Right, so that will move us one... That will move us one step up, and the last story will deal with a physical cause and a lot of ambiguity about whether it's direct or indirect.
That's
right. That's okay. I've been tried yet. Yeah.
And why don't you want to look at the halacha as it's developed? I mean,
the purpose,
we're getting it from somewhere.
The purpose of this class, right,
okay,
purpose of this class is to do narrative. In the summer, I'm spending the whole summer on the halachic things, but I don't think that there's enough halachic precedent to extend by pure analogy.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I'm uncomfortable the way a lot of contemporary halacha seems to have developed, which is by taking these stories normatively.
These stories.
Yeah. So I'm trying to see if there's a middle ground in which you can take the stories seriously without taking them as directly legally normative. As I accept that Tzitzit Eliezer's removal, mm-hmm. but I like the admission in his last thing, you know, but really, bottom line, this story does tell me that. Mm-hmm. And so I want to see if I can get some kind of principles that I can derive from the narratives as narrative, that I can then use as the basis of law.
Right. So let me ask you a question. Where is the line between narrative and halakha? I mean, okay.
Too big a question, Kevin. It's 9:15.
Is it? Okay.
Too big a